Cause like a winter tonight, I thought I would always have light. The quick flash that you gave to me, so dark I could barely see. Looking
from wherever you are around the world, welcome and thank you for joining us. Today we're exploring the psychology of profiling with retired FBI agent Peter Klismet. He is the author of FBI Diaries, Profiles of Evil, and FBI Animal House, which have garnered national awards in nonfiction categories. Let's welcome him to the circle. Welcome, Mr. Klismet.
Thank you, Colonel. It's my pleasure to be here.
Very, very fascinating books. I've read the FBI Diary, Profiles of Evil. Boy, I tell you, it's one of those books you got to read during the day. Really creeps you out at night.
Well, I've heard that. In fact, one of my three sisters said it was frightening enough to her that she actually couldn't finish reading the book. So I guess something in there struck a nerve.
Well, it's kind of funny because I know there's what we call availability bias. You see something over and over again, you think it's much more prevalent. And I just reading the book all of a sudden made me think there was a killer about every other house. But I'm sure that happens a lot, I guess, because of the media. But we'll get to that a little later. So can you tell me a little bit about what made you write the book and a little bit about your background?
Well, background-wise, I actually started out in law enforcement, not where you are now. I would say after I finished college, I went on Ventura PD. They were the only police department in the entire world at the time that required a bachelor's degree. So I thought, well, I had one. Let's go. And wound up out there for about 9 years, a little over nine. And then while I was going to graduate school, got talking to some FBI agents, and they said, why don't you apply? So I did, and ultimately wound up getting hired after a period of time. So went in the Bureau, wound up in Los Angeles for a couple of years, then wound up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And it was in Iowa where I was chosen to be one of the first, what was then called psychological profilers in the history of the Bureau. And so in addition to my other duties that I had, a lot of other cases, I did get calls on profiling cases. And so that's really what brought about the book, is that it was kind of a matter of, I guess if you've got some knowledge, I feel like it's important that you should be able to share that knowledge with other people. So I have a kind of a training mentality. But I also think that it's important in that book, and you notice that nobody has ever actually gone inside the behavioral science unit, as we called it then, and explained what kind of training we got. I mean, it was not a matter of going in there, they anoint you with some magical oils, give you the imprimatur, and say you're now a profiler. I mean, it was, as you saw, it was pretty tough in reading the book. So that's pretty much it. That's what got me going on writing it.
I got to ask you this question, I guess. The very first murder case, I think a lot of people always wonder, how were you? Did you get queasy? Were you okay with it?
Well, the very first murder case I had was I started Ventura PD on a Monday, and on a Friday we had a case, I'll never forget the name, Frank Volpe. It was a murder case, and so that was my very first one. Went to the autopsy the next day. All of these things are rather shocking to a 24-year-old that has never seen something like that before. But in terms of the profiling aspect of seeing, and I assume that's what you're talking about?
No, actually, the very first time you ever saw one is perfect. Everybody tries to wonder, what is it like the very first time you see it? But it seems like it shocked you. You still remember the name. And how long ago was it? You were 24.
It was very shocking. It was July of 1970. In fact, it was probably about July 8th. I think I started July 1st. And, the guy was with his girlfriend in an apartment, and this other girlfriend, he was two-timing her, showed up with a knife about that long and knocked on the door. He answered the door, and he wound up with the knife right here, and that's exactly where he was lying when we wound up getting there to the scene. So,
were you apprehensive?
Shocking.
Were you apprehensive as you arrived?
Not really, because I was working in detectives at the time and assisting a detective. I was kind of his partner. And so we already knew what had happened. And, woman had been arrested. The guy was dead. It was just odd seeing a person lying there on the floor with a knife sticking out of their chest. I've seen a lot of bodies over the years, and it initially is kind of a surreal thing to see.
That's exactly what we're trying to explore, so that's wonderful. So let's get into the nitty-gritty here. What is the profiling process? You were mentioning it a little bit. It isn't magical spells or ointments or anything like that. So what goes on? How did you guys get started?
Well, it takes a long time to explain it. In fact, I taught a full semester college class in profiling, Carlos. But simplifying it, kind of boiling it down, I guess, it's using evidence from a crime scene to look at a crime scene in a different way, because what we're trying to do is to identify different behaviors. Why did a person do those types of things, perhaps to a victim, and then using that to build a behavior profile of an unknown type of an offender. So what I look at it is kind of the old solution matrix that all of us learned when we were cops went exactly like this. It was who, what, where, when, how, and why. And at the very bottom is why, and that would seem to be the most, or the least significant. And so the way I learned was to take the why, to flip that matrix upside down, and to look at a crime scene in terms of why did certain things happen. And so that's really what the behavioral, that's what the profiling process was called then. And frankly, that's what I call it now.
Well, let's start digging in a little bit. There are various types of killers.
Yes.
There's serial killers, there's killers out of revenge, as you mentioned earlier, even jealousy killers. Is there kind of some kind of taxonomy you guys follow or something?
Well, every single case is a little bit different until probably you get into serial killers. And for the sake of any listeners, the definition of a serial killer is somebody that kills three or more people over a period of time. And that doesn't mean 15 minutes. That usually means weeks, perhaps. So kills three or more people over a period of time with what's called a cooling off period in between each one of the killings. So that's what a serial killing is. Now, serial killers, by definition, kill more than one person. Consequently, between each of those, there may be some similarities. There's what we call method of operation, and there's a signature. And if one were to watch Criminal Minds on TV, there is some thread of reality to that show. Not a whole lot, but some.
A very thin thread,
and
huh?
So, that's where a lot of this stuff comes from.
So is it a very thin thread?
Pretty thin thread, yeah.
Pretty thin thread.
In fact, I was quoted in a newspaper here about a year ago as saying, I did not have an analyst that could use a computer to identify a border collie in Montana at a sheep farm, cross-match that with a video in New York, and then also triangulate that with a saguaro cactus in Arizona, and using those three disparate things to come up with a suspect. That, nor did I also didn't have a Learjet accessible to me, nor a whole team. It was me. I mean, it was my bureau car. That was it. And
just
so
you?
It was me. Anything you read in that book was me, other than me being smart enough to call the behavioral science unit occasionally and say, help. And you noticed that too. I had no hesitancy admitting that.
Now, so did you ever go on the field then for some of your cases? Because I know they do. I'm not sure if that's real or not.
Most of the crimes had occurred before I got there. I can't recall specifically an instance when I went to a crime scene like they do on TV, and there's still a body lying around. I can't imagine that happening. I mean, they'll fly from Washington or wherever they are, Washington, D.C., out to Olympia, Washington, which is 3,000 miles away. And they get there and there's still a body lying out there in a forest or something. And so a lot of that is unrealistic. But then again, so is CSI on TV, one of the most unrealistic shows I've ever seen. It pulls in the audience, it attracts them, it looks more interesting that way. Even though they have advisors that, like myself, were former profilers, if they would read that book, FBI Diary Profiles of Evil, I think they would start to understand that this stuff is not as, shall we say, stereotyped or stereotypical, is what they want to believe.
That's for sure. And I know we have some pictures. I just want to warn the audience, they are a little graphic, but we do have a crime scene. And before we get to the crime scene, I wanted to know if you can differentiate between a disorganized killer and an organized killer.
Yeah, a disorganized killer. Well, let me start with an organized killer because I guess the two different typologies were formulated by a guy named Roy Hazelwood, who remains a good friend of mine and one of my mentors, as a matter of fact.
He's got a difficult book to read, too.
You did what?
He's got a difficult book to read as well.
Oh yeah, Roy's got a couple books out, and so does John Douglas
John Douglas, yes.
and Bob Ressler, but. A disorganized type of a killer is going to be somebody that's more methodical. Just to make this more sensible and quick, more methodical, having planned things out, and probably then is going to have or going to be a little bit older, in the sense that they're probably going to have had a chance to formulate that planning ability over the years. So I'm going to say 25, 30. And even older than that. A disorganized offender then is going to be the antithesis of an organized offender. Typically, what I find is that they don't plan the crimes that they do, they're very spontaneous. And so oftentimes we're dealing with a younger offender. Now, that would sort of preclude. The person that is mentally unstable, mentally ill, perhaps paranoid schizophrenic, and then the paranoid schizophrenia usually hits men at about the age of 25 or so, and you probably know that as well as I do, if not better. Okay,
Right.
so two very different typologies.
Right here is the chart too. You gave us a wonderful slide here, organized and disorganized offender.
Yeah.
I know on your slide you have above average intelligence for the organized offender.
Yeah, and a lot of people again have these stereotypes that a serial killer, for instance, has to be somebody that has drool running out of their mouth and blood in one eye and a fang sticking out the other side, and that you can look at them and tell, oh, this guy's a serial killer. But the reality of it is, the serial killer is the guy that lives right next to you. He's in the house right next door to you. Don't go out and take a baseball bat to your neighbor, but that's more likely what a serial killer is. Gary Ridgway up in Washington State, for example, the Green River Killer, very normal appearing guy, very normal type of a job, very normal house area, and yet killed 48 women up there in Seattle, Washington. So.
Welcome to Adelante. This is Adelante Recovery, and my name is Yvette Kuglin, and I'm part of the staff.
Adelante Recovery Center has helped people in dual diagnosis for 5 years. We accept most PPO insurances and provide luxury accommodations and 24-hour support. To speak with an admissions counselor, call 1-888-242-4450.
A lot of time, we don't even know what's wrong with us, and sometimes we need to get away, figure that out. So if you want to go for a little retreat out in Corona Del Mar, which is a confidential location, we're here to help. So we're only a phone call away. Thank you.
Actually, I wanted the audience, I'm going to read down the list. You can see the list right here. It's amazing if you put all these things together. Above average intelligence, socially competent, high birth order, father's work stable, controlled mood during crime, lives with a partner. I mean, this does sound like your neighbor next door most of the time.
Yeah, and in fact, it certainly usually is, Carlos. That's the truth. And so that's, you know, that's one thing that makes what we say is they hide in plain sight. They're out there, but it's very hard to identify them because they are very methodical. They plan. They get better at what they do, and nobody suspects them when they're caught.
You got to apologize. I have to apologize for this, but I'm not sure if this is the same guy. I think it was when I was reading one of the books, the BTK killer.
Yeah.
He seemed to be one of the guys in the neighborhood. Wasn't he even a softball coach?
Well, even more than that, the BTK killer was in Wichita, Kansas, and he was like a pillar of the community. He was very prominent in his church in Wichita, and, you know, was married, had a family, and in fact had a degree in criminal justice from Wichita State.
Really?
So, you know, figure that out. Method to his madness.
How many did he kill? 20?
I think BTK killed about 14.
14?
Yeah, I think it was 13, 14 people.
Amazing. Now, yes. There's a case in your book that was really fascinating, and I know it made an impression on you just by reading the chapter. I could see that. Can you discuss a little bit about Ed Gein or Gein?
Yeah, Ed Gein, again, one of the things that we do is we learn a lot from studying what these people did, what they were all about. And so Ed Gein was one of the people that we did study. And, you know, people say, well, Ed Gein was from back in the 1950s. Well, that's true. But a lot of these characteristics of serial killers and others don't really change that much over the years. It's just the faces change, method of operation or signature may change, not a lot. Ed Gein lived in a little town of Plainfield, Wisconsin, outside of town. He was a farmer, had 160 acres out there. And his mother had died. Ed Gein had undoubtedly killed his younger brother a number of years before, and technology was not such that they could figure it out back then, but this is in the 1950s in a small town in Wisconsin, ironically about 40 miles north of where I was born, Stevens Point. But Ed lived on a farm by himself, and Ed was a number of things, one of which was a grave robber, and he would read the paper after a woman would die. Then the next night or the night after, he would go out to the cemetery, dig that body up, and then take the body, if not in total, take parts of the body back to his place. And so he then became a model, I guess, for the movie Silence of the Lambs, the part of Buffalo Bill, if you recall it. Because he would take the skin off the body. Now, I know this stuff is really gross, and when I wrote this stuff in the book, you probably weren't particularly enjoying that part, but there's some other stuff in that book that is as bad, if not worse, with Ed Kemper up in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, Kemper's but, a character.
Yeah, so he would actually make use the skin of the victims to make furniture and use the skulls of the victims as bowls for soup. And I'm not trying to gross people out. It is what it is. And these are the facts. And these are some of the things that we had to learn when I went through, as I call it, profiling boot camp back in Quantico.
Let me ask you this question. So some people are probably going to say, well, the guy was completely off his rocker. He was either delusional, schizophrenic. Did you find that? Did you actually, you never met him though.
No.
But did you find anything out that like that during your research of that case? Did he seem like he was just completely gone? Did he have schizophrenia or anything like that?
Well, back in the 1950s, they wound up finding him to be mentally ill because, frankly, back then they didn't have these types of things happen. So, if you killed more than a few people, and he did kill a few people, then you had to be crazy to do something like this. There was no other explanation for it. So they found him mentally ill. They put him in a mental hospital. Then they said he got unmentally ill, and they got him out of the hospital. They tried him, convicted him, and then stuck him in the state penitentiary where he died. I may have missed your question. Did I answer that?
No, you did. I was just trying to see if there's a diagnosis, but I know it's an older case, so it's kind of hard to diagnose that. But what I want to do, too, right now, the next picture we're going to have is a little graphic. It's an actual murder scene, and we're going to kind of go through it a little bit for people. We have, I think it's a woman laying on the floor in a kitchen, and the reason we're doing this is to kind of get an idea. There are some things here that you see, because you're a trained professional on this. But I know I phrased it wrong in one of my questions before the show, but the body, the way it's being laid out, it's left there lying on the side.
Yeah. And
I don't know. What does that tell you when you see that?
Well, you have to take the picture as a whole, I think, and look at it because it's what we would call a messy crime scene. And I mean, it doesn't take a Dean's List candidate to figure that out because there's stuff all over the place. So I would look at that crime scene initially. I mean, I'd stand back and look and say, well, okay, we're probably dealing with a more youthful type of offender that didn't really plan this out, that may have busted in the back door, seeing the victim in there, and went after the victim, probably acquired a weapon while he was inside the place. So there's no planning involved whatsoever. The victim got away. The victim fought. He was unable to get the victim under control. So now I'm looking at a disorganized offender. Why? Because an organized offender would have had this planned out, would have probably gotten in the house, like many of them did, BTK, for example, and would have gotten in the house, would have quickly had the things he needed there to get the victim under control, a gun, a knife, perhaps a rope, or some other mechanism to get the victim under control. This one didn't in this scene, and I think that's why it's important, because it exemplifies a disorganized type of killer.
I completely agree. And does it matter how the body is on the ground? I mean, if it's face up, criminal minds, kind of, you know, I don't know if it's Hollywood or not. I mean, sometimes you see the killers, and they've laid the body down with their arms crossed over, or face down, or face up, and the BAU agents will look at it and say, oh, look, the face is down. So there might have been some kind of remorse there by the killer. Is any of that stuff true?
Yeah, there is again, a thread of truth to that. And this thread is probably a little thicker one than the one I mentioned before. But, it is true. And if a person, for example, has killed someone and then puts something over their face, oftentimes we consider it a form of what's called undoing. So what does that tell us? Well, it tells us something similar to if a person kills a victim and leaves that victim's body in a place out on a county road, for example, like one of the stories that you read in the book, then if they do that, it's a very subtle psychological thing. They want the body to be found, or they want to undo this crime because, you know, it's kind of like they don't want to acknowledge that they did it to a victim that they knew, I guess is the best way to put it. So what's that going to tell me? Well, what it's going to tell me is that I've got an offender that in all probability knows a victim.
Fascinating. That's
kind of narrows things down a little.
Huh?
Narrows things down a little, doesn't it?
Very much so. It's amazing how you just immediately got that. I mean, I would have spent 4 or 5 hours trying to figure that whole thing out.
Well, and I would have too, but, you know, there's things like that I've had cases where when I notice that type of thing, And oftentimes, I'm not at crime scenes looking at victims. I mean, let's face it, I'm looking at pictures, I'm talking to officers, and I think, again, in the book, the FBI Diary Profiles of Evil, you saw that I would wind up at a crime scene like I did out in Beatrice, Nebraska, 2 weeks, 3 weeks after the crime had occurred. But that's fine, because I've still got things I can look at, and photographs, and autopsy report, and police reports, and make the same determinations, essentially.
And a couple more things. We have about 1 or 2 minutes left here. Trophies, we've heard that term as well. Is that a true thing?
That's a real thing, particularly with serial killers. Why will they take them? Oftentimes they'll take them to use them later in reliving the crime, maybe fantasizing about the crime. And so, it is not unusual in the slightest for us to find trophies being taken.
And something you mentioned earlier on the show, signatures, those are common as well?
A signature is something oftentimes that a person does that's unique to them. I mean, they got their method of operation. They've got to use a car. They've got to use a gun. They've got to use certain mechanisms to get the victim, let's say, in the car and under control. Then, once they are dealing with the victim, do they need to torture that victim to kill them? No, they got a gun there. Do they need to do post-mortem types of things to the victim? No. And so those types of things become a signature, kind of like the killers in Washington, D.C. that were leaving a card at some of the places. And so it can be a taunting type of thing, but quite often it's a very real thing for a person to have a very unique signature.
I remember watching, I can't remember, it was a documentary on the Unabomber, I think it was the Unabomber, and one of the FBI agents, I think it was him, it was actually sending her mail and talking to her. And I can't remember if it was the Unabomber or who it was. It was a serial killer, or maybe it wasn't the Unabomber, maybe it was a serial killer. He was actually sending her mail and kind of taunting her a little bit. Did that ever happen to you? Did any
it
of these
never
guys
has
respond
happened to me. But I certainly know of a number of occasions when it does, and not only taunting the officers, perhaps even taunting the family. And that happened with Polly Klass out there in California with her family, the guy, Richard, I can't remember his last name, that kidnapped and killed Polly, was taunting the family, as I recall. It's not unusual. These guys are sadistic. Their minds are much, much different than ours. And it gives them a little power and a little bit more control, and so they kind of get off on that.
Thank you so much for the insight. Thank you so much for the work you did for us as well as an FBI agent. I truly appreciate that. Thank you for being on The Circle, Mr. Klizmet. Once again, I highly recommend it. Very fun read, FBI Diary, Profiles of Evil. And why not? Get the FBI Animal House. That's a great book as well. Once again, thank you everyone for joining us. Remember, our motto is simple. Wherever there's psychology involved, even in profiling, we are there. See you next time, everyone.